This year, experience the NHL playoffs your way. Want to watch a single? Do or die Game 7, a full week of heavy-hitting back-and-forth series. Then check out Sling's 1, 3, and 7-day passes. Watch the Chase for the Cup on ESPN and TNT, starting as low as $4.99. No long-term contracts or overpaying. Just live hockey at home or when you want it. Sling lets you do that. Visit sling.com to learn more.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Welcome to the Divergent Files podcast.
A baby was born in Philadelphia, and within days, doctors realized he might not survive. Not because of an infection, and not because of an injury. Because somewhere deep in his body, one instruction was off. One tiny broken line in his DNA, a rare metabolic disorder, severe enough that toxic ammonia could start building up faster than his body could clear it. And then something happened in 2025 that should have sounded like science fiction, but it didn't. A team at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and Penn Medicine didn't just treat this baby, they built a gene editing treatment around him. Not for the condition in general, but for this child, for this mutation, for this particular emergency. A custom CRISPR-based edit designed around his exact mutation, then delivered into his body while he was still small enough to fit in a hospital crib. And the wild part is, the early results suggest it helped. The child's name is KJ. And according to the public record, KJ became the first reported patient to receive a personalized CRISPR therapy built around one person, one baby, one mutation, one shot at more time. CHOP, the CHOP, called it a first-of-its-kind breakthrough. And researchers said it could become a model for rare genetic diseases where waiting years for a standard treatment just isn't an option. And if that sounds beautiful, well, it is. This is one of the most incredible things modern medicine has ever pulled off. A baby who might not have had a future got one. A family staring at a clock got more time. And to be crystal clear, that's not the scandal here. That part is the miracle. That's what science is supposed to look like when it's actually on your side. But this is where that miracle starts casting a shadow. Not because saving KJ was wrong, because it wasn't. But it starts casting a shadow because now the world knows this can be done. And not in theory, a real child, a real edit, a custom treatment built for one human being, delivered in time to matter. Because once medicine proves it can build a genetic fix for one child, fast enough to matter, the whole conversation changes. Because if a hospital can build a genetic fix for one dying infant, how long before someone tries to build one for an infant who isn't dying? And not to save a child, but to improve one. To give their child better odds, a stronger body, a sharper mind, or maybe just a little more protection than everyone else's kid. So the real question isn't whether this kind of CRISPR is coming. The real question is who gets the next custom version and who decides what better is supposed to mean. So what is CRISPR really? Because people hear gene editing and immediately picture some billionaire lab in a mountain bunker with a glowing tube and a guy named Victor. But that's not what this is. The weird truth is we didn't invent the system. We found it inside bacteria. And that matters because bacteria have been in a knife fight with viruses for billions of years. Tiny little one-celled organisms. No brain, no eyes, no committee meetings. Just trying not to get killed by things even smaller than they are. Those viruses are called bacteriophages. Fancy word, simple meaning. Viruses that infect bacteria, and they are relentless. A virus latches on, injects its genetic code, hijacks the cell, makes copies of itself, and blows the place apart. That's basically the whole business model. But some bacteria evolved a nasty little trick. When some of them survive one of those attacks, they can keep a tiny scrap of the invader's DNA, basically a mugshot, a genetic this guy right here file. That storage strip is basically the CRISPR part. The name is ugly and academic because apparently science names things like it hates microphones. But the idea is simple. It's a storage strip in the bacteria's own DNA where it keeps little pieces of old viral code, like a wall of wanted posters, tiny criminal lineup. Then if the same virus comes back, the bacteria don't have to guess. They've seen that face before. Then you need the other half of the system, the Cas proteins. Think of those as the tools in the drawer. And the one everybody talks about is Cas9. Cas9 is the part that does the cutting. So now you've got the basic setup, not mystical, just deeply weird. A targeting system and a blade, which is already a little unsettling because one of the biggest scientific revolutions of the century is basically built on bacterial revenge. So this is where it stops being just microbiology and starts becoming our problem. Scientists realize that if you can tell Cas9 what sequence to look for, you don't have to wait around for a virus to show up. You can point it at its chosen sequence, and not perfectly, but precise enough to make the old rules feel suddenly outdated. A mutation, a disease-causing error. So in plain English, humans figured out how to hijack a bacterial immune system and turn it into programmable DNA scissors. And to be fair, this wasn't the first time anybody had ever tried to edit genes. There were older tools before CRISPR, and that part matters. Zinc finger nucleuses, talons, real things. Smart people spent years building them. This wasn't caveman science. But those systems were harder to design, harder to retarget, often more expensive and more finicky. So basically the kind of tools that stay locked in the hands of a small group of specialists. But CRISPR changed the mood fast. Because suddenly, instead of building a whole new machine every time, you could keep the same cutting tool and just change the guide. Same scissors, new address. And once that clicked, the field moved like somebody had kicked a door off the hinges. A system bacteria evolved to survive virus attacks became one of the fastest moving platforms in modern medicine. The scary part wasn't that we learned how it worked. The scary part was how quickly we learned how to aim it. So here's the part that makes this whole story harder to talk about. CRISPR is not some evil lab toy. You don't have to squint to see the upside. For a lot of families, the upside is obvious. It looks like a kid finally getting out of the hospital. And that's why this gets complicated so fast. Because once you strip away the headlines, the weird internet panic, and the reach people sci-fi fantasies, CRISPR is already making the moral argument harder in the most inconvenient way possible. Because it's helping people. Real people. Sickle cell disease is probably the clearest example. If you've never really looked into sickle cell, well, it's brutal. It's a genetic blood disorder where red blood cells are supposed to be soft, round, and honestly pretty boring. But instead, they get warped into these hard little crescent shapes. They clog blood vessels. They cut off oxygen. They trigger pain crises severe enough to land people in the ER again and again. Stroke risk goes up. Organ damage piles up. And little by little, life gets smaller. For a lot of patients, especially kids, it's not one bad event. It's a whole childhood organized around flare-ups, hospital visits, missed school, in a body that keeps betraying you. And then, in late 2023, the UK approved Casgevy, the first CRISPR-based therapy for sickle cell disease and transfusion-dependent beta thalassemia. The US followed in December of 2023, approving Casgevy for sickle cell disease. Then in January of 2024, the FDA expanded that approval to transfusion-dependent beta thalassemia, another inherited blood disorder where some patients spend years tied to regular blood transfusions just to function. That was a real line crossed. And the way it works is honestly pretty wild. Doctors collect the patient's own blood-forming stem cells. They edit those cells outside the body. Then they put them back in. That edit helps the body start making more fetal hemoglobin again, the kind babies naturally make before birth. That version doesn't sickle the same way. So instead of trying to fix every broken blood cell one by one, they basically change the blood factory upstream. And that's not science fiction. That's just medicine getting weird. And to be clear, this is not some quick little injection. It's intense. It involves collecting cells, editing them, preparing the body for the return, and then putting those edited cells back in. The early outcomes that made people pay attention were not subtle. In the FDA summary, 29 of the 31 sickle cell patients with enough follow-up were free from severe vaso-occlusive crises for at least 12 straight months after treatment. So, in plain English, for people whose lives had been shaped by repeated pain emergencies, many suddenly had a year without the thing that used to own them. That is not a small improvement. That can change the shape of a life. And not in a slogan way either. In a real calendar on the fridge type of way. And sickle cell is not the only place this started moving. Beta thalassemia is one. There are rare inherited blindness programs. Cancer researchers are testing CRISPR-edited immune cells so they can recognize tumors better. And now, after KJ, there's the possibility of personalized N-of-1 gene editing treatments for rare diseases so uncommon the normal drug pipeline barely notices they exist. Some of this is approved, some of it is still in trials, and some of it is still in the promising but everybody breathe bucket. But still, the pattern is clear, enough now that pretending this is all still future tense would be dishonest. So it's already here. And that's what makes CRISPR so morally persuasive. It introduces itself by offering relief, less pain, more time. Maybe your child gets something close to a normal life. And once the technology starts doing that, well, people stop asking whether it should exist. They start asking how fast they can get it. That's totally human. It's understandable. Honestly, it would be weird if they didn't. If your son had sickle cell, if your daughter had a rare mutation that was going to kill her before kindergarten, you are not sitting there debating bioethics like a grad student with a podcast. You're signing the forms, you're making the call, and you're praying the science works. And that right there is the real trapdoor. Because the first version of CRISPR that wins public trust is not the scary one, it's the merciful one, which is exactly why the next line got crossed so fast, and why almost nobody was ready for what came next. And here's where the line everybody said would hold for a while didn't. Because once CRISPR started proving it could help real patients, a lot of people assumed the dangerous stuff would come later, like years later maybe. But the usual human fantasy that we put brakes on powerful things before somebody gets bored and floors it. That is not what happened though. In November of 2018, a Chinese scientist named He Jiankui stood before the Second International Summit on Human Genome Editing in Hong Kong and defended something the scientific world still didn't know how to process. He said twin girls had already been born. From embryos, his team had edited with CRISPR. Not lab embryos kept behind glass, not discarded experiments. Children had been born. He called them Lulu and Nana. And the room basically had a collective out-of-body experience, because that was supposed to be the line. For years, the broad consensus had been that editing human embryos in a way that could pass down to future generations was ethically radioactive. Researchers had talked about it. The science was moving. Everybody knew the possibility was there. But the assumption, or maybe just the hope, was that nobody would actually go first. But he did. Or at least, he claimed he did. And then the Chinese authorities, court records, and the global scientific response treated the basic fact of the births as real. His stated goal was to disable a gene called CCR5. That gene can play a role in how HIV enters certain immune cells. Some people naturally carry a mutation called CCR5 Delta 32. Depending on how many copies they have, that mutation can make HIV infection harder in some cases. So the public-facing pitch was simple enough to sound noble. The father in the case was HIV positive. He said he wanted to give the children a form of protection. That is how this was sold. And that right there is why this section matters. Because this was not framed as vanity. It was framed as prevention, protection, even safety. That kind of moral language is very powerful. It can make dangerous technology sound like the responsible choice. But when you slow down and look at what he actually did, the shape gets uglier. These children were not being treated for a fatal childhood disease. They were not sick with HIV. This was not the same as KJ, where a child had a known lethal condition and doctors were racing the clock. He, Jiankui, edited embryos, transferred them for pregnancy, and allowed those edits to become children, with changes that, if present in the right cells, could potentially be passed on to future generations. That is called germline editing. In plain English, you are not just changing one patient. You might be changing their bloodline. And that's a very different category of decision. But wait, it gets worse. Because the actual edits reportedly did not cleanly recreate the known natural CCR5 Delta 32 mutation that people talk about. They created different changes, less understood changes, and in some reports, mosaic changes, meaning not every cell necessarily carried the same edit. So even inside the same child, the edit may not have been uniform, which is a nice little reminder that when humans say, we edited the gene, what they often mean is we aimed at it and now, well, we're hoping the biology behaves. And that's not a side detail. That's the whole problem. The science wasn't ready. The ethics weren't ready. And the public, sure as hell, wasn't even in the room. The global backlash was immediate. Researchers condemned it. Bioethicists condemned it. Governments condemned it. Even scientists who were bullish on gene editing looked at this and basically said, absolutely not. Not like this. Because if you normalize embryo editing before safety, before consensus, before long-term data, you may not be advancing medicine. You may just be kicking open a door nobody knows how to close. So, China eventually prosecuted him. And in 2019, a Chinese court sentenced He Jiankui to 3 years in prison and fined him 3 million yuan for illegal medical practices. And if you stop the story there, well, it almost sounds reassuring. A rogue scientist got caught, he was punished, so maybe the system worked. Except, not really. Because prison doesn't undo proof of concept. The scandal was never that somebody wanted to do this. Of course somebody wanted to do it. That part is almost boring. The scandal was that by the time the world heard about it, it had already been too late. It had already been done. Human embryos had been edited, transferred, brought to birth. Human reproduction had crossed from editable in theory to editable in practice. Once that becomes true, the next danger is not just another rogue scientist trying to be first. The next danger is something much more ordinary. People with money. People who don't want their kid to be the one left behind. And that fear can move faster than any law on earth.
This year, experience the NHL playoffs your way. Want to watch a single? Do or Die Game 7, a full week of heavy-hitting back-and-forth series. Then check out Sling's 1-3 and 7-day passes. Watch The Chase for the Cup on ESPN and TNT, starting as low as $4.99. No long-term contracts or overpaying. Just live hockey at home or when you want it. Sling lets you do that. Visit sling.com to learn more.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Most people still hear designer baby and they think science fiction. A billionaire couple in a private lab picking eye color, IQ, and whether little Brayden is born already qualified for the Olympics. But that version makes people laugh because it sounds ridiculous, which is convenient, because the real version is already sneaking in through the side door, and it looks a lot more normal than people want to admit. It looks like fertility clinics. It looks like anxious parents sitting across from a doctor, trying to make the least terrible choice. Sometimes it looks like love. That's what makes it dangerous. Because in the real world, the first phase of design is usually not editing, it's selection. With IVF, parents can create multiple embryos in a lab. Then those embryos can be tested before one is implanted. Some of that is completely legitimate. Pre-implantation genetic testing, or PGT, can screen embryos for certain serious chromosomal problems or inherited mutations. That part matters because not all of this is sinister. Some of it is parents trying to dodge a nightmare already written into their family history. If your family carries a brutal disease and you have a chance to keep your child from living that nightmare, well, most decent people are taking that deal. I know I would. And if we're being honest, you probably would too. But that's a trap, because once you accept the idea that embryos can be compared, ranked, and chosen, the moral ground starts sliding whether anybody wants to admit it or not. At first, the question is simple. Can we avoid this disease? Then the question shifts a little. Now it's, can we lower the odds of this other thing? And before long, somebody is asking, can we give our kid a better shot? That's how this stuff usually happens. And this is where polygenic embryo scoring starts creeping into the conversation. So in plain English, instead of looking for one obvious disease mutation, polygenic scoring tries to estimate risk by combining a whole bunch of tiny genetic signals from across the genome. Not certainty and not destiny, probability. Which sounds harmless until somebody tries to sell it to scared parents. Now, to keep this honest, because this matters, traits like intelligence, height, athletic performance, impulse control, stress tolerance, none of that is clean. None of it. Those are messy, highly polygenic, heavily shaped by environment, and nowhere near build the baby decision. Your kid is not a custom gaming PC. Although, give the market about 5 minutes and somebody will probably offer a subscription plan. Genetics matters. So does nutrition, and sleep matters too. And so does whether you raise them like a human being instead of a startup investment. Small detail, apparently. But even with all that uncertainty, the market still moved. Companies like Genomic Prediction have marketed embryo ranking tools based on polygenic risk scores, pitching parents on the idea that they could choose embryos with lower projected lifetime risk for conditions like heart disease, diabetes, certain cancers, and some mental health categories. Their LifeView branding drew major backlash, and some of the more controversial screening claims were reportedly walked back. But the important part is not that it got criticized. It's that it existed. That door opened. And the people who get first access to that branding are not going to be regular families scraping together grocery money and hoping the rent doesn't jump again. It's going to be people with money. Because IVF in the US can often run between $15,000 and $25,000 per cycle. And that's before you add medications, testing, freezing, storage, repeat attempts, and all the other premium add-ons that somehow get introduced right after you're emotionally vulnerable and sitting in a beige office pretending this is all normal. So right from the start, this technology comes with a price gate, because the first people who can afford embryo screening beyond the basics, risk ranking, boutique genetics, insights, optional layers of optimization, all the little extras that sound medical until you look at who can afford them, well, they are not just buying medical help. They're buying selection power. If wealthy families start using these tools only to avoid catastrophic disease, most people will support it. Of course, fair enough. But the second those tools start being used to tilt toward lower psychiatric risk, better projected health, taller stature, cognitive proxies, emotional regulation, or even athletic upside, even if the prediction is messy, we are in a totally different world. And once that logic takes hold inside families, it doesn't stay inside families because the Pentagon notices. It always notices. The Pentagon does not need a super soldier. It just needs fewer failure points. And that's the part people miss. They hear gene editing and jump straight to some ridiculous comic book version of the future, with giant dudes, steel bones, laser eyes, a jawline that could cut drywall. But that's not how real militaries think. They think much smaller and meaner, more or less more practical. Can a body recover faster after injury? Can it tolerate less sleep without falling apart? Can it hold together longer under stress, infection, blood loss, extreme heat, cold, radiation, etc.? Basically, whatever ugly thing war throws at it. And that's enough. You don't need a genetically engineered action figure. You just need a warfighter who breaks a little slower than the other guy. And to be clear, that does not mean we have public proof of CRISPR-built soldiers, because we don't. And once you understand that, the receipts start landing a lot harder. Because DARPA did not treat CRISPR like some distant science project. They treated it like something that could affect whether people are ready to fight, survive, and recover. Their Safe Genes program says exactly that. Not in a coded language either. It's straight up. DARPA says the program supports force protection and military health and readiness by protecting service members from the accidental or intentional misuse of genome editing technologies. That means by the time most people were still saying, wait, CRISPR can do what? The Pentagon was already funding the control layer, not just the tool, but the leash. And that matters, because Safe Genes was not just about watching gene editing happen. It was about control, countermeasures, and even reversal. That's the mindset of people looking at a technology and immediately asking, how bad could this get if the wrong people get there first? Then it moved closer to the field. DARPA also launched DiJet, detected with gene editing technologies. It uses gene editing systems as rapid field diagnostics, basically turning the same biological logic behind CRISPR into a fast detection tool for pathogens, biomarkers, and whatever else the military needs to spot early. So, in plain English, gene editing didn't just enter hospitals. DARPA was working to pull the same logic into the military's early warning system, and the Pentagon was already thinking about the darker side early. Because back in 2017, Wired reported that the Pentagon funded a National Academy's review into synthetic biology and gene editing threats, and that the preliminary report went through classified review before release. So, again, it's not proof of a secret lab full of edited soldiers. But it's not nothing either. That is not proof of some secret mutant platoon, so we're not going to embarrass ourselves. But it is a clean receipt that the defense world was already asking the weaponization question years before most of the public had even caught up to the medical one. So by 2025, the National Security Commission on Emerging Biotechnology was publicly saying the quiet part out loud. And this is a congressional commission. Not some guy with a garage podcast yelling about civilization collapse between ad reads. Their report warned that biotech is now a national security race, that the US risks falling behind China, and that biotechnology could shape future battlefields, improve warfighter resilience, and help maintain military advantage. That is not hidden. That's the public version. Okay, so then there's the Ratcliffe claim. In 2020, then-Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe publicly claimed U.S. intelligence showed China had conducted human testing on PLA members in hopes of developing soldiers with biologically enhanced capabilities. That is a real public allegation. It is not the same thing as a public proof packet, of course, that line matters. But the fact that a sitting DNI said it out loud tells you the Overton window was already blown open. And that's really the point of this entire section. Because from there, the military logic gets ugly real fast. It's no longer, can we build Superman? Because that's stupid. The real question is, can we reduce fatigue? Can we speed recovery? Improve wound healing? Can we make soldiers more resilient to infection, stress, and environmental hell? can we harden the force without calling it enhancement? And it gets much darker than enhancement. Because once biology becomes military infrastructure, the question stops being just how to improve a body. It becomes how to understand it, sort it, maybe even target it. Now, that doesn't mean we have clean public proof of DNA-tailored weapons, because we don't. But the fear of that is already enough to change how power sees the human body. That's not a comic book question anymore. That's policy. If you're wondering why we're suddenly talking about eugenics in a CRISPR episode, well, here's why. Because CRISPR did not invent the urge to sort human life. It just gives that urge a sharper tool. The technology is new, yes. The instinct, though, is old as hell. And before the comments section itself lights on fire, let's keep this real simple. Eugenics is the idea that somebody gets to decide which humans should reproduce more and which ones should reproduce less, and which ones maybe shouldn't reproduce at all. And this was not just a Nazi thing. That's the comforting lie people tell themselves because it keeps the mirror at a safe distance. The United States was deep in it. Starting in the early 1900s, more than 30 states eventually put sterilization laws on the books. Not theories, actual laws. People labeled feeble-minded, poor, disabled, institutionalized, epileptic, mentally ill, or simply socially inconvenient could be sterilized by the state. Historians estimate roughly 60 to 70,000 Americans were forcibly sterilized under those laws. That wasn't fringe, that was policy. Then came Buck versus Bell, the Supreme Court. Carrie Buck was ruled unfit and the court upheld Virginia's right to sterilize her. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. wrote one of the ugliest lines ever attached to American law. I quote, "Three generations of imbeciles are enough." And no, that ruling was never formally overturned. It is not used the same way now, but it is still there, sitting behind the wall like mold. And it wasn't just here. Sweden sterilized around 63,000 people from 1934 into the mid-1970s, often under the language of public health, social hygiene, and fitness. Different country, same fantasy, that institutions can improve society by deciding which humans deserve to continue and which ones don't. Then World War II happened, and the Nazis showed where that logic goes when nothing stops it. And the word eugenics became radioactive, which it should have. But the label collapsing is not the same thing as the impulse dying. Because after the war, the ugliest language disappeared, yes, but the sorting instinct did not. It can hide inside language like prenatal screening, genetic counseling, risk reduction, better outcomes. And again, carefully here, some of that language belongs to real medicine, real care, real autonomy. Some of it helps families avoid devastating inherited diseases, and that matters, of course. But here's the bridge to CRISPR. Modern fertility medicine already allows embryo selection. With IVF, multiple embryos can be created in a lab. And right now, most of that is still selection. Not full CRISPR redesign, not custom building a child from scratch. Not yet, at least. Old eugenics mostly tried to control who was allowed to reproduce. Modern reproductive medicine can already help decide which embryos get chosen. CRISPR is where that old instinct can start moving from selection into redesign. And if society rewards one genome and quietly punishes another, you don't need forced sterilization anymore. You just need a system that makes choosing one kind of child feel responsible and choosing another feel avoidable. Now, if that sounds extreme, wait until you see what happens when access to better genes starts stacking at the top. For most of history, inequality lived outside the body. It was brutal, and it still is, but it usually showed up as money, law, school quality, healthcare access, zip code. Who got the safe neighborhood? And who got the chemical plant downwind. That mattered, like, a lot. It could shape your whole life. But it usually wasn't sold as a way to pick or alter your child's genetic starting point before that child was even born. That's what makes this different now. Because once embryo selection gets normalized, inequality can stop being just a social condition. It happens the normal way, the boring way, the rich people way, actually, quietly. A couple pays for IVF, then deeper screening, maybe expanded screening, maybe risk scoring. One clinic offers the best possible start. Another offers advanced embryo health optimization. And none of it has to sound sinister at all. That's how it gets in the room. Because the first generation of this probably won't look like superhumans. It'll look like marginal advantages, a lower disease burden, better recovery odds, fewer inherited risks, maybe stronger stress tolerance, better metabolic health, better sleep. Whatever gets packaged first as preventative care instead of enhancement. And once one family can buy even a small biological edge, every family that can't starts feeling the pressure. Every family that can't starts feeling the pressure, even if nobody says it that plainly. That's where this stops being just a private medical choice and starts becoming a way society sorts people before they even arrive. Because if a child with better projected health becomes cheaper to cover, easier to underwrite, or less expensive to support, well, the markets notice. They always do. If those children seem to perform better over time, schools notice. Quietly, maybe, but they notice. If they recover faster, burn out less, and show fewer disruptions over time, employers notice too, because of course they do. And yes, there are laws meant to block genetic discrimination, but laws do not erase markets, incentives, and status pressure, or the quiet ways systems reward whoever arrives easiest for the system to handle. And there's one more thing here. For most of history, nature still had a vote. Rich people could buy tutors, they could buy better schools or a better zip code, but they could not buy their way this directly into chromosomes. If biology joins that menu, even randomness starts getting priced out, which sounds insane until you remember how much people already pay to avoid uncertainty. We already live in a world where people pay extra for better schools, better neighborhoods, private tutors, concierge medicine, and then fertility treatment, premium prenatal care, early intervention, custom nutrition, layer after layer, all of it dressed up as responsibility. People will mortgage their soul for a 3% edge, and they'll call it sacrifice. Look, if biology joins that menu, they will not suddenly become monks. That is not how humans behave. Unfortunately, we have records. And once the future starts selling better children by subscription, we are no longer talking about healthcare. We're talking about a split at the starting line. And if that keeps going long enough, we're talking about a species split. Maybe the part that should bother us most is not the technology, because CRISPR is a tool, a powerful one, sometimes even a beautiful one. It can do real good. It already has. That part is true. What keeps sticking in my head is what happens when a tool like that leaves the lab and lands inside markets, governments, fertility clinics, insurance systems, and eventually families. Because parents are where this gets really hard. Most parents would crawl through broken glass if they thought it gave their kid a better shot. Not because they're monsters, because they love them. That's how this kind of thing gets accepted. Through fear, through hope. Through a father who doesn't want his daughter starting life one rung lower than the kids whose parents could afford more. That's what makes us different. The first real shift here may not look cruel. It may look compassionate. And once that starts, the danger is not just gene editing. The danger is that a civilization slowly starts acting like some future humans are better investments than others. Not more loved, just better bets, healthier, easier for institutions that already sort people for a living, and somehow still call it neutral. And eventually, whether anybody says it out loud or not, it becomes hierarchy written into the starting line, deeper than money ever reached. And if you follow that all the way through conclusion, what still counts as human.
This year, experience the NHL playoffs your way. Want to watch a single? Do or Die Game 7, a full week of heavy-hitting back-and-forth series. Then check out Sling's 1, 3, and 7-day passes. Watch The Chase for the Cup on ESPN and TNT, starting as low as $4.99. No long-term contracts or overpaying. Just live hockey at home or when you want it. Sling lets you do that. Visit sling.com to learn more.
Thanks for being here tonight. If you want more stories like this, you know where to find me, you know where the links are. And if you choose to support the channel, it really helps. I'll see you next time.
This year, experience the NHL playoffs your way. Want to watch a single? Do or Die Game 7, a full week of heavy-hitting back-and-forth series. Then check out Sling's 1, 3, and 7-day passes. Watch The Chase for the Cup on ESPN and TNT, starting as low as $4.99. No long-term contracts or overpaying. Just live hockey at home or when you want it. Sling lets you do that. Visit sling.com to learn more.